Welcome to your future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you. At CEJA, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. CEJA's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the CEJA banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
To introduce another Yes to Life show looking at aspects of integrative medicine for cancer. The show's named after the UK registered charity that I founded about 13 years ago to offer people some choice and control in their treatment by helping them to access the benefits of integrative medicine. My guest today on the show is a woman with cancer, just one of the mass of people who are tragically diagnosed every day, who has become an extraordinary survivor by any standards and highly informed in one particular field that she ascribes much of her incredible success to, off-label or repurposed drugs. These are established, safe drugs normally used for another condition that happen to affect the progress of cancer. Jane McClelland was on the Yes to Life show about a year ago following her enthusiastically received appearance at last year's Yes to Life conference, since when she's pushed forward the cause of off-label drugs substantially. I called Jane to catch up with her on the latest developments.
Hi Jane, thanks very much for coming back on the show to give us a bit of an update.
No problem.
You're just back in from the US, all fired up with having given two presentations at the Tripping Over the Truth conference, with a couple of your heroes there, Travis Christofferson and Tom Seyfried. Yep. What for you was the highlight of your trip?
Ooh, highlight. I think actually it was catching up with Seyfried in the bar and having a pretty good chinwag with him, actually, and getting down to the nitty-gritty of some of the metabolic processes that go on and some of the ways that he's looking at starving cancer and me discussing some of the other ways could work. So that was interesting. Travis kind of just sat in the middle, grinning like a Cheshire cat, I think, just not quite knowing what to say. But anyway, it was a fantastic conference. I mean, they had about 36 or so speakers from all over the world. I mean, some of them couldn't get there because of, you know, some of Trump's latest problems with visas. People just couldn't get there, which is such a shame. Ahmed Al-Safar, I think, was from coming from Israel or somewhere, and there was people coming from the clinic, the chemothermia clinic in Istanbul. Yeah. Anyway, they were trying to come as well, and I think they both of them failed, sadly, which is such a shame. But they had a really wide breadth of people, you know. I mean, they had people like Ko Young, who's been looking at the 3BP. Gregory Riggins, who is another hero of mine, he's been investigating mebendazole for brain cancer. So I had some really good chats with him as well. Obviously I went with Ndaba Mazibuko from the Care Oncology Clinic. So, I mean, lots of people who are investigating off-label drugs and things, and Akbar Khan from Canada, who is investigating DCA. So I had a chat with him too. So I mean, I had so many. It was such a good networking opportunity for me to meet these people and actually just chat through, you know, the reasons why these things work, and also Miriam Kalamian. Yeah, she was great. Right. She does a lot with the ketogenic diet. So loads of really, really, you know, top people. I don't, you know, it was just such a fantastic group. And I mean, I have to say, this was probably all instigated as a result of your efforts last year.
thank you.
Because Travis, no, I'm serious, because Travis was so impressed with what we did, or you did, you know, getting the people together for the talk last year, with the whole emphasis being on this metabolic approach to cancer. And Travis was so impressed with things that he heard and how it was structured, and with the Care Oncology Clinic. I mean, he loved my talk as well, said, you have got to come to the US. So, I mean, it was great. So, you know, he kind of pushed George Yu, who is a surgical oncologist at Johns Hopkins, to sort of do this. And he's keen as mustard anyway. I mean, George Yu is a lovely guy. And, he really wants to push the field of the metabolic approach to cancer to a level where it is incorporated into general oncology, because it's still not accepted as a, you know, a serious form of treatment, which is a travesty. So he got some amazing people together, and for me it was just a fantastic experience, not just being able to talk at such a great conference, but to be able to talk to all these other people who I, you know, I've only spoken to or heard of through email, or, you know, so to actually meet them face to face was just fantastic. So that was just a great highlight for me.
Right, sounds like you're completely in your element there.
Oh totally.
Yeah, very good. So for the uninitiated, maybe you just better introduce who the two heroes are that I mentioned at the beginning, Travis Christofferson and Tom Seyfried. Tell us why they're sort of heroes and what they've done and are doing.
Yeah, Tom is really the pioneer. Well, he's taken on the whole Warburg theory that was developed by Otto Warburg in 1926, I think it was, that cancer cells produce energy in a different way to normal cells, and their use of glucose is highly inefficient. It's sort of a fermenting process which requires an awful lot more glucose, so the uptake of glucose is much greater in cancer cells. So it has been kind of denied by the whole cancer industry. Certainly the conventional cancer industry has sort of denied that this is a potential opportunity for treatment. And they focused on the genome and all the genetic changes. It's known as the somatic theory of cancer mutation. So it's all the treatments currently that are used in orthodox care are focused on the genetic changes, and even the targeted therapies are very much focused on the genetic changes, so that they completely ignore the potential for starving the cancer, which is where I've always thought that the opportunity for weakening and making the cancer much more vulnerable to other treatments should be focused. So Tom Seyfried published a big tome on the metabolic approach to cancer. I can't remember what year it was published, but
5 years ago.
5 years ago. Okay. Well. Okay. So, yeah, that was after I'd already got myself better using similar methods. Yeah. Your listeners probably don't even know anything about me. So, the short version is that I was diagnosed with cervical cancer in 1994 at the age of 30. I had a recurrence in my lung in 99, which was stage 4. I kind of kept it under control with a lot of natural therapies and trying to, obviously diet was hugely important, and I did many of the natural things that would be familiar to many of your listeners, you know, green tea, resveratrol, lots of things like that. So all the kind of usual, intravenous vitamin C. And then in 2003, I had some very bizarre blood markers going on, and it turned out that I was developing leukemia as a result of all the chemo and the radiotherapy that I'd had in the past. So that was then kind of a bit of an emergency to me. And that led me to looking at something more than just the natural therapies, because they clearly were not working for the leukemia. They might be working for the cervical cancer, keeping that under control, but they weren't keeping the leukemia under control. So I have a background in medicine, in that I'm a chartered physiotherapist. So I had some understanding of, and I kind of at this stage got myself to a point where I was kind of an amateur oncologist. So I was looking at every single piece of research I could lay my hands on. And I, you know, it wasn't just looking at alternative stuff. I was looking through medical journals and PubMed, etc., you know, and trying to find things that had evidence. Not necessarily clinical trials, but things that had evidence for efficacy in cancer. And I came across statins, dipridamol, and etodolac, which is a non-steroidal. In fact, all non-steroidals seem to be very effective for cancer. I'd already earmarked aspirin back in 1999 as being very useful. In fact, I'd also asked about other non-steroidals at this point as well. But I part of my first talk, my presentation in America, was more focused on the perioperative period, which is what I now see as a critical period for making sure that metastasis doesn't occur. But anyway, so I then managed, with these drugs, with this combination that I kind of devised, and it took me several doctors to acquire my little cocktail, but then I sort of launched into sort of self-experiment, I guess, in putting the cocktail together and doing it on my own. With my doctor's blessing, you know, I did check that the drugs weren't going to interact badly. But they're all low toxicity, and put the combination together, and hey presto, cancer disappeared. So that was in 2003. And then my cervical cancer, and I only took these drugs for a period of a few months, mind. So and then the following year, I kind of went off the rails, and then the cancer, my first cancer, started to come back. So I then took my cocktail again. I added a couple more things, and bingo, went away again. So I knew I was onto something very important. And since then, I have been trying to champion these old off-label drugs. And this is since, 2003, 2004. And it took until 2015 to find anybody who was doing anything with them. And this is when I discovered the Care Oncology Clinic in London, doing a very similar combination, because I sort of integrated metformin at this stage into my combination as well. And they were looking at still are looking at a combination of metformin, statins, doxycycline, and mebendazole. And mebendazole is a drug that's used for pinworm. So it's a very low toxicity drug. And that is showing huge potential for brain cancers. And it's the use of these very low toxicity drugs, but in combination, which I always felt was key, so that you're targeting more than one pathway at the same time. And I'm very pleased to see that, the Care Oncology are getting fantastic results. They'll be publishing their results, I think, sometime early next year. Hopefully about the same sort of time that I published my book, which has been in the offing for a long time. I've wasted an awful lot of time talking to publishers who haven't quite been able to pigeonhole me into their little niches, because I'm not a doctor. So, a lot of them weren't really serious, and I do have some serious medical information in there. And then the other ones just want a memoir of the sort of fluffy type, which again I'm not prepared to do. So I'm sort of somewhere just don't really fit. Yeah. I don't really fit.
You don't really fit. I think that has to be said about the whole approach, is it doesn't really fit into the kind of medical model either.
And
it's new as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, this path is a totally new path that up until recently nobody really knew about. And I've been jumping up and down saying, please, please look at these off-label. Why is nobody... And as soon as I discovered the Care Oncology Clinic, I was so excited. Well, but nobody else seemed to be excited with me. It was kind of, look, guys, look! Look what's happening! And I had eventually I thought, right, well, I'm going to have to launch my own Facebook group and try and educate people, which is eventually what I did. So in the summer of 2015, I launched Jane McClelland Off-Label Drugs for Cancer. Really short, easy title.
Yeah.
And people can look me up and join if they want, because it's full of, you know, I try and keep it full of science. We have good discussions about the drugs and lots of, you know, there's inspirational stories on there as well. So it's good for clinicians as well as for patients. It's an educational tool. To try and steer people into, you know, what could be the right combinations. Because I'm not just saying my combination is right for everybody. I don't think it is. But it certainly worked for two types of cancer that I had. And it's a matter of targeting. And this is one of my theories, is that cancer is a bit like the London Underground, in that you have to block all the different tube lines, because cancer has different fuel lines. And if you just do one, then it has the opportunity to sort of reroute itself and come back in a different, you know, down a different tube line. So it's a matter of blocking off every single, well, not every single, you don't necessarily need to do every single one, but certainly the main fuel supplies need to be cut off so that you weaken it. It will either be killed off more easily by, you know, chemo or radio, and you don't need as high doses as they're giving. I mean, what I'm trying to say in my book is just that we should be rethinking the entire approach to cancer, that we've got everything completely wrong. We should be tackling it we seem to be using the wrong drugs in the wrong combination, in the wrong order, and at the wrong dosages. So we just need to just think about everything in a completely new light, flip everything on its head, and do kind of some of the things that we're now doing for stage four. We need to be doing, you know, right at the beginning, but using really low toxicity things first, and saving the really more powerful things for when, you know, when we really need them. Because that stage one and stage two, I reckon, could be thwarted quite easily with a combination of old drugs. It's my firm belief that, you know, it's quite possible that we could be getting rid of cancer in a far less aggressive way than we currently use. So I think there is huge potential.
Well, thankfully, some of the treatment is, they are thinking like that. I mean, if you look over the history, basically the treatment for cancer got worse and worse in terms of what the patient got, you know, for a long period. Yeah. It was, you know, chemotherapy got stronger and stronger, and they found ways of keeping the patient alive when they should be killed by it, and this sort of thing, you know, the kind of doses they were doing. But they've eventually started cutting back and realising it actually does just as well with much less. So it is heading in that direction. So
I think a lot of them still use the maximum tolerated dose. I mean, my oncologist was quite sure she was going to kill me, and she said so when she gave me the chemotherapy, and I had to beg her to drop it, you know. And I meant to only have one or two big dosages before I sort of begged her to drop, you know. This was always my game plan, to try and put on a big drama act and get her to drop the dose, which I did. But it took me until after my third go before I did it, because I was so impressed with the way that chemo was working initially, but I hadn't cottoned on to the fact it was probably because I was taking berberine at the same time, and I had no idea that it was going to be that effective with it until I, you know, some of the research I've done since, I've gone, aha, there've been so many aha moments writing my book that and I continue to get aha moments, and I've got to stop researching finish writing the thing and get it out, because there are just too many aha moments.
You can always write the next one, Jane, if you can just get that one finished.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So look, a reminder there, if anybody wants to hear some more about your story and all your use of all these different drugs and what you found out, we have got another show with Jane recorded earlier, which you go to the Yes to Life show page on UK Health Radio, scroll down and you'll find it there on Listen On Demand. So, yeah, your book, what are people going to expect, and when do you think they can expect it?
Okay, so what will they expect? That to start with, it's my story, and what I try and do is I weave the medical information into the story, so it's not a heavy medical tome, if you like, but it does talk about what I used and why I used it at various stages of my cancer. And I come up with several theories in my book, which have actually, you know, since I have proven that, you know, this is actually will be the future of cancer, is to starve it. My book is actually called How to Starve Cancer. And initially I was going to call it How I Starved Cancer. But as I researched, I realized that what I did actually was applicable to every cancer, and that actually if I worked out more pathways, then I would be able to say, this is how to starve cancer. And it would be applicable to more than just a few cancers, but, you know, the vast majority, because they all have abnormal metabolic pathways. And it's a matter of determining what those pathways are. And they're all slightly different in different cancers, which is why they behave differently. But once you've worked out what they are and then worked out how to block those, then you kind of come to sort of one answer of how to starve it. And then the next, that leads on to sort of the next theory, which is then just blocking its potential for metastasis, which of course is the main reason why everybody dies. 90% of deaths aren't from the primary, they're from the secondary. So this is, it's all about containing the cancer. And there are various ways to do that. You know, you block the growth factors, and also you can block something called MMPs, matrix metalloprotease inhibitors. So there are various drugs and natural things that do that, natural compounds. And so it's just getting the right mix in order to effectively starve your cancer, you know, and then you weaken it, and then you can use much lower doses of things like chemo or radiotherapy. Intravenous vitamin C. There are various different options that you can then choose to kill it. So it's much easier thing. It's much easier beast than I think people maybe perceive it, because I think we tend to use the big stuff, the chemo and the radiotherapy, in far too high doses. I mean, everybody knows that. So that we are destroying the patient at the same time as trying to destroy the cancer at the moment. And that's really entirely the wrong approach. And what I try and do is put forward a new approach and a new theory of how we should be approaching cancer with a very simple three-step process. So it's to starve it, stop the growth, stop the metastasis, and then you snuff it out. So it's kind of a very simple process, but not using the really big stuff, the chemo and the radiotherapy, right at the start. It's using them once you've got the cancer under control, because it has too many defences, and you have to stop all those defences, which it can recruit, you know, and all the different metabolic pathways that it uses to evade the chemo and the radiotherapy. So you get those under control first, and then you give the chemo and the radiotherapy. And to me, I think my theory works, or in theory should work, much better than the current way of treating cancer, which is far too toxic.
Okay, all very interesting. And so this is all bundled up in your new book, and you think it's going to come out early next year?
Yep, I am aiming for end of February.
We all heard that. Yeah. Very good.
That's the plan. But I'm, you know, I'm having to self-publish, so I'm trying to sort of raise funds to do that at the moment. And I'll probably try and get pre-orders. And I'll try and get maybe... My aim is trying to get about 250 pre-orders, and then I can sort of press a button kind of thing. So yes. I'll probably do that through my website, which is How to Starve Cancer. It's currently .co.uk, but it'll probably be .com. Either or. So that's kind of where I am at the moment, to try and give it a reasonable launch. And I've got some journalists and people on my on my Facebook group, so they're very keen to write about it. So hopefully I will get quite a bit of publicity for it when it comes out too. So
self-publishing is sort of the way to go for pioneering stuff. Just as social media has made it possible for you to have a voice for what you've been wanting to bang on about since whenever it was, 2000, 2001, it's given you a way to talk to people about it. So self-publishing also has given a way for people to put out books that can't be pigeonholed. As you were saying, you know, you're not a doctor and you're not telling one of those romantic recovery from cancer stories, you know. Well, you are, but it's only part of it. It's probably the right way to go.
Well, yes, of course, we'll see how it goes. I'm very keen now to get the book out there. And one of my talks, one of the presentations that I gave, and I gave two, my first one I called How to Be a Revolting Patient, was really more about empowering the patient and how to approach the doctor-patient relationship in a positive way, and to put forward, you know, your own wishes and choices, particularly if you're stage four, because at the moment, you know, you're dying. In their eyes, you are dying. So their approach is kind of still my way or the highway, unfortunately. And I actually showed two straw polls that I'd done on my Facebook group, one which I did in 2016 and the other one in 2017. And we rated oncologists. This didn't go down, well, it won't go down particularly well if an oncologist sees this, but the view of the patients was that, the number of doctors who scored a zero, in other words, they were really dogmatic and didn't want the patient to try anything other than their way. Unfortunately, there was a score of 55% had zero in 2016, and actually it was 74% between a score of 1 and 4. And that frankly is a toxic relationship. And then we went on to 2017. I did another one this year, and the scores had improved. We had a 61% sort of 0 to 4. And out of that, you know, we had only 41.5% were a zero. So that was an improvement, but that may have been slightly confused by the fact there were more patients on my site who were not stage four. I've got sort of a greater mix of patients on there now, as the word of repurposed drugs and old off-label drugs has sort of kind of spread. There's been quite an explosion of interest in them.
Right. Can I just ask how many oncologists got a really gold star for being great?
1%.
1%. 1 out of 100.
Oh. Yeah.
Okay. Well, room for improvement.
I think actually what I'm doing quietly is making a list of the good ones, and also making a list of the bad ones, because I think people need to know where and who they can go to, who's going to support them in this metabolic approach. Because frankly, if they're all against it, you know, the patient ends up having this toxic relationship where they're lying to the oncologist. The oncologist is kind of fudging things and not telling them. The whole thing is a disaster. You know, it's not an honest relationship that you have with the doctor. And we can't move forward. We can't have proper conversations without a completely honest approach. And it's terribly bad, the situation at the moment, terribly bad. The whole thing needs massive, massive improvement. And, you know, somehow we have to educate the oncologists. But unfortunately, that education has got to come from the patient, because it's the only way they're going to actually hear it, because they're not going to hear it from the pharmaceutical industry, because all these old drugs are obviously pennies and there's no money in it. So it's never going to come back down through the pharmaceutical industry. So if the reps aren't telling the oncologists, then they won't get to hear, you know. So it's kind of a learning from the patient rather than this dogmatic listen to me from the oncologist. Unfortunately, it's got to be a patient revolution, which is why I've got my Facebook, and yeah, why you have your book out there to arm the patient with that information, to empower them and to make them feel that yes, there are things that they can do beyond what the oncologist is telling them, and there are, you know, there is hope. It's quite possible. I think stage 4 cancer is almost always, as long as there's not too much organ damage involved, I think that it's very possible to reverse stage 4 cancer. So I think people should, you know, really hold out some hope for that in the future, if the right combinations of drugs are used, and, you know, people do things in the correct order, in the correct way. But we're a long way off that at the moment. So but I'm hopeful.
Right. Okay. Great. So you were saying earlier on about your snappy title for your Facebook group. You didn't think of calling it a revolting patients thing.
I should. Yeah. All right. But anyway, yes, if people want to find it, it is Jane McClelland, and that's McClelland, yeah, off-label drugs for cancer. And it is full of scientific PubMed articles, things that people can actually download, take to their oncologist to actually say, look, this shows that in my cancer, this might, you know, this could actually be very useful for me. Do you support my use of going to see the care oncology clinic? Do you support my my need to change my diet? But maybe the diet should actually be left as the last thing to discuss. Yes, well, actually, part of my presentation, my first presentation, was talking about some of the interactions I'd had with oncologists. And one of them was taking a friend of mine to an oncologist at the Royal Marsden. And I downloaded and got hold of, and in fact, I'd actually bought, because I couldn't get a hold of it any other way, an article from 1985 from The Lancet. And it was a study. It wasn't actually a randomized clinical trial, but it was a study on dipyrimal. And I had a really good article on a statin for melanoma from melanoma research. It was all peer reviewed. I had some other stuff from gastroenterology for the use of a non-steroidal with a statin. And I took all of those with me. But even so, I was, you know, asked to leave. I had the door slammed in my face. I was shouted at. And then I had the relatives. And this, the most shocking thing was the relatives afterwards, you know, they were outside in the corridor. We were all asked to leave because he was so, you know, he said, right, you need to, you know, I want to speak to you alone. Everybody leave. And then the relatives started attacking me in the corridor, jabbing me with their fingers. And it was just really awful. It was awful, the whole situation. I thought, right, that's, you know, so much for trying to get these off-label drugs for people. I'm just going to give up. So when I found the Care Oncology Clinic in 2015, you cannot believe how pleased I was. It was just the most amazing thing to me. Finally, there was a clinic out there doing what I wanted people to do, which was to incorporate old drugs into clinical practice, because to me it was a glaring omission, and I'm so pleased that we are now starting to incorporate these things. As you know, metformin is definitely becoming more acceptable. So we're still a long way from getting all these other drugs incorporated, but at least metformin is starting to be accepted, and statins are kind of making a little mark on oncologists' charts, but really we're still a long way off getting them as standard treatments.
Okay, so could I hop back to something you mentioned right at the beginning of the show? You were talking about exploiting the perioperative period. You said that,
yes,
in regard to your talk. And I just want to talk a little bit about that. Well, firstly, can you explain what a perioperative period is? And then tell us how patients could actually exploit it.
Yeah, well, the perioperative period could be anything from days to weeks, both before and after an operation for cancer. And surgeons kind of pride themselves that they are sort of getting cancer patients better more than oncologists. You know, they get slightly cross that oncologists tend to get all the sort of big news with their new immunotherapies and all this in the newspapers, and that the surgical side never really gets much of a mention. And obviously removing a tumour is important. But on the other hand, you need to be prepared for the operation, because the damage that can happen when you have, to be frank, I mean, a surgical operation for cancer throws in an awful lot of risks. Three things certainly come to mind. Inflammation is a key driver of cancer, and, you know, taking a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory both before and after, to me, is absolutely key. I mean, what I did was I asked my surgeon when I had my lung cancer, the secondary in my lung, whether I could take aspirin, and obviously I couldn't take it just before, but I delayed my surgery for 5 weeks. So for 4 weeks, I took the aspirin, and I should have probably swapped to taking another non-steroidal, you know, ibuprofen or whatever. But he was very negative about that as well. He was negative about the aspirin, but I ignored that. And, you know, I just feel that, and there are people like Mike Retzky, who I quoted in one of my presentations, who's shown that, you know, it makes an enormous difference. And there's a fivefold increase in the risk of relapse is decreased rather by, you know, five times if you take a non-steroidal of some sort around that sort of perioperative period.
Massive.
It's a massive effect. And if we are going to change the current dismal statistics for cancer, that is the number one primary easy thing that we could be doing. It's just taking a non-steroidal around the time of surgery. And that would make a massive, massive difference to our survival statistics, which frankly are shocking. I mean, the UK has the worst in Europe. And, you know, there are reasons for that. But frankly, we are lagging way behind. And just simple little measures done at the right time could make such a difference, such a difference.
Mm.
So, yeah, and to quote some numbers, Mike Retzky, who I've actually since been in contact with through email, because he's written a whole great big, he's written a book actually on the perioperative risks and how to reduce your risk, both of, you know, because there's a release of circulating tumour cells for a start, you've got the inflammation, and also affects your immune system. And there are various things you can take during that time. And he was the one that quoted, you know, fivefold reduction over a period of 9 to 18 months in that, you know, if you took the a non-steroidal around the time of surgery. But there's another group led by Ben Eliyahu in, I think he's in Israel somewhere. But anyway, they looked at, and this was in 2015, and this was a very similar combination to the one that I put together. They suggest propranolol, which is a beta blocker. They suggested etodolac, which is actually the non-steroidal that I took, and a statin, and omega-3, which is almost identical, apart from if you swap the propranolol with the dipranolol. That is my combination. Not that I took it at the time of my operation, but I took it sort of further down the line But dipridamole and propranolol have some similar effects on the circulation. Propranolol also has effects on vascular endothelial growth factor and also the immune system, and it will reduce your adrenergic response, which obviously can increase cortisol, which will then increase insulin. And it's just a way of helping to control that potential for spread. So there are some very simple, easy, cheap ways that you can just increase your chance of survival. But it, you know, even if you haven't done that, all is not lost. If you didn't take those things around the time of surgery, and a lot of people probably listening to this show will go, oh God, if only I'd done that. You know, it's not over. I didn't take all those things. I did take a bit of aspirin. So it's there are some easy little interventions that will make big differences.
Mm. All right. Well, it sounds like very important information, and I know that other people are doing research in that field at the moment.
Yeah.
And yeah, extremely important.
We'll be in the book.
Good.
Doing these talks, doing these presentations in the US has kind of focused my mind on the really key issues. And, you know, the perioperative period is key if we want to change the, you know, the misery and suffering that people go through. You could instantly change these survival statistics just with using a non-steroidal around the time of operation. And then the right drugs at the right time, in the right order, in the right combination. Again, it's just a matter of getting the right combination for your own cancer. And not every, you know, they won't all respond in the same way. Some cancers are more glycolytic, other ones are more glutamine driven. And fat is an area that people haven't quite cottoned onto yet, but fat is a major driver. It's a major way that cancer uses to fuel itself. And, you know, the ketogenic crew are kind of off. I mean, it does help. I'm not saying ketogenic diet is bad. It doesn't. It's good for many reasons, particularly as it reduces your glucose load, your glycemic index. And so it has many benefits. But if you don't take the right oils, if you're not careful about what you have as your fat, you know, in the long term, it can kind of rewire through the acetate pathway, which is a ketone. So, you know, and this is something that, again, patients need to be educated about. But there are ways to get around that, and there are ways to block that as well. So I talk about all of that in the book.
Mm, that sounds like the subject of another whole show, that does.
It's kind of it's questioning many of the things that are even done today and where we are at the moment. I'm kind of trying to see, trying to have my crystal ball as to where I think we should be. But, you know, maybe I'm ahead of my time, or maybe I'm completely wrong. People can make up their minds when I get my book.
Yes.
So
look, yeah. We've got to wrap up pretty soon. I just wanted to have a few throwaways at the end. You talked about focusing on the places where you can get the really quick wins, if you like. With if you intervene in the right place at the right time, where do you think the biggest win is to be had, in fact?
Well, I think it's at diagnosis. That is where the biggest win could be. I mean, like I said in my presentation, you'll diagnose and then you wait. So they give you, there's a period between your diagnosis and having your surgery normally. What do they give you? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. You know, that nothing is given to you during that time. It's a prime opportunity to be handing you some cheap off-label drugs to take a combination just to get, you know, just keep it under control and then reduce the inflammation so that when you have your surgery, you are in a fit state to sort of keep it under control. And then you hit it with various things to help reboot the immune system to, you know, stop it spreading. Immediately in the post-op period, and that is the big hit. That's the big hit right at the beginning.
Okay.
That is where we're failing. Okay. That's a massive, massive failure to me.
So, just say the principle of using off-label drugs were to be embraced wholesale. what kind of impression do you think this could make on the state of cancer care in the UK?
Well, for a start, we could make massive savings, as well as, you know, savings in terms of financial as well as lives. So it just could be so big. This could be the game changer for so many things. And I'm not just talking because of my own personal experience. I just know from people on my site, people that have gone through the Care Oncology Clinic, I'm witnessing the fact that these drugs work to various degrees, to various states. And I think the Care Oncology Clinic have a fantastic base combination. And I think it could be enhanced with certain other additions for certain types of cancer. And I explain why I think certain things could be added in and what could be added in for the slightly trickier ones to treat. I think this could be a massive benefit for prevention, for treatment, for actually changing the whole attitude to cancer, which is sort of like pouring too much toxicity into the patient, nearly killing them in the process. We could be treating cancer as a sort of a long-term disease, a bit like a diabetic patient or, even HIV, where they take cocktails of drugs over a period of time. And HIV, you can have a normal, pretty much normal lifespan and normal health if you take the right combination of drugs. Now, what I do, I take only a few of the drugs now. In fact, the only two I really take regularly are metformin and aspirin. I take those every day. And I alternate the metformin and the berberine. And then every now and then I sort of do a hit of my a cocktail. So I sort of give it a quick splurge, if you like, just to try and sort of make sure if there are any cancer cells starting to take hold, that I give it give my body a bit of a clean out every now and then. But that's my approach. It's very much akin to sort of treating it as a long-term disorder. And I don't know whether I'm cured. I have no idea.
No.
But, every now and then if I get a panic or if I think I've got, some kind of... And I'm just like every other cancer patient. And in that you just... Even now, I'm now... How many years? 18 years since my 1999 diagnosis. So... I just think it is something that I will probably never be able to completely park as being cured. I can't ever claim to think that I am cured, but I certainly think I can keep it under control. And I still see myself as being a stage 4 cancer patient, but whether I have stage 4 cancer, I don't know. I don't know.
If you're having a completely good, healthy life, it's almost academic whether or not you've got stage 4 cancer.
The whole taking a few drugs every now and then, what the hell? It doesn't matter. It doesn't affect me. It's not like they're toxic or anything. Even the aspirin, people get terribly worked up about aspirin, but the risk of aspirin is so low, really. People get so worked up about these stomach bleeds and things, but actually a lot of, this is in my talk, the real risk is actually only 2.2%. Most people are stunned at that. They think it is much, much higher.
Right.
It isn't. The risk with aspirin, with not other non-steroidals, the risk is higher. But with aspirin itself, it's only 2.2%. And if you take it regularly, your body kind of acclimatizes to it. And so after about 3 years, your risk of bleeds very much reduced. So I think people are scared of aspirin, whereas sort of spontaneous bleeds are far more dangerous. So there's a lot of fear mongering and a lot of misconception and a lot of, we're far from having an optimal situation where rational decisions are being made on the basis of your diagnosis and what really is a risk and what really isn't a risk.
Okay, yeah. Look, we're out of time. Great to have a catch-up with you, Jane, and also really great to hear that your kind of passion for bringing the good news of your discoveries to the world is beginning to pay off. You kept at it, and people are beginning to listen, and obviously, once you get your book out there, that's going to be another huge step. So
keep going. Looking forward to seeing the book. A big thank you to you for coming on the show today.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, Robin.
It's a fascinating topic, and there's no doubt that off-label drugs have a huge potential to help large numbers of people. Go to the Yes Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk, and click the link on the homepage to the Yes Life show information page, where you can find links to resources mentioned by Jane in this show. I'll be back again next week with more insights into the world of integrative medicine, and I hope you'll be able to listen again. Goodbye. Thank you.